You are not finished with your life. This is not your end. Nonsense. It made me want to die just to irritate you, but I didn't. So why should I sit here and watch you make the same slow farewell?
Nicholas's left arm began to shake under the strain of holding his weight. He shifted, leaning forward with a grimace.
Then why did you agree to follow me to the auction?
She looked at him as if he'd asked her why chickens lay eggs.
Because I'm going to find the witch and stick a bunch of knives in her until I find the one soft, fleshy spot that makes her take your blasted ring off.
He did not want to tell her that she was in the deepest sort of denial if she truly believed she could convince the witch of anything. The stories Ironwood had told him about the woman made his skin crawl, and he had very little doubt that killing her, or wounding her, would only cause the poison to work faster. She was as merciless as they came, and the only way to truly get his revenge on her would be to take the astrolabe and ruin her chances of adding another secret or soul to her collection. He wasn't surrendering the ship. He was going down with it, and on his own terms.
You said that Julian and Etta,
Nicholas said, trying to stamp out the ember that began to glow dangerously inside him again.
That they were planning to attend the auction, or at least apply for entry to it.
They were, though judging by Lyndon's expression, I think I put her off the idea, Sophia said with one last confession. I told them what's going to happen when the astrolabe's destroyed. Neither of them took it very well.
It was amazing that, for all of their similarities, neither Etta nor Sophia could decipher each other or understand the other's minds. Nicholas translated Etta's reaction for her.
That only means she'll be there to try to steal it.
There wasn't enough gold left in the cash for the entry fee anyway, Sophia said. I came back and checked about an hour after you'd left, and Ironwood's cleared out the other ones Julian would know about.
That would pose an actual problem, though he had little doubt that Etta could think her way through the situation.
Then you're likely right, and they won't be there. You've kept them safely away from any trouble we might cause.
Stop trying to make me feel better, Sophia ordered. It won't work. I'm determined to be angry and guilty about this for at least another 2 days. And then again when I'm punching your corpse.
He tried his best to smile.
Though I sincerely doubt they believe you. You attempted to keep my pretense to maintain our plan, even in the face of great emotional turmoil. Ma'am, I regret to inform you that you now have honor in spades.
She pulled a hideous face. Ugh, is that why I feel so terrible? Take it back, it's awful.
Nicholas shook his head ruefully.
Can you not see it, though? How your situation might align with...
I don't want to hear this.
How it might align with Li Min's, he pressed on. She kept up the pretense on behalf of another that only served to keep Etta safe and alive. This whole situation might have taken a different direction, certainly, but it wouldn't have changed the manner of the deal I made with the Belladonna. Nothing but Ironwood's death or her mercy will take the ring off, and neither will ever come to pass. At least now something good might come of it.
She rubbed at her forehead.
I don't really want logic right now, Carter. I mostly want murder.
Will you settle for an end to this? He asked. It's all I can offer at the moment.
How can this not change anything for you? Sophia asked,
that same pleading note bleeding back into her words.
Why can't you be selfish like the rest of us?
Etta's alive. Julian is safe. Li Min is gone. All of these facts should have tilted the earth itself, upended him. But it changed nothing. It was better if Etta did not know about the ring, about the bargain, about his choice. She would fight him every single step of the way, and he couldn't risk being taken off that path now, not when he was so close to seeing everything through. But the weight of that, knowing he was intentionally keeping her in the dark yet again, felt as though it might crush his entire chest. He had to fight for his next breath.
I'm...
He tried to give a name to the quiet storm inside of him, but the moment he grasped what it was, it slipped away again, and all that was left was weariness. Resignation. He felt now like he was taking on water, moving forward sluggishly toward an inevitable end. The thought of Etta breathing, fighting, filled the dark sky of his thoughts with stars. If he stretched out on his back, closed his eyes, he could imagine himself on the deck of that ship. He would be able to see those stars falling once more, arcing down in one last flare of brilliance. It was seared upon his memory as she was. Whatever would come the next night, Etta was still in possession of her life. He was unspeakably grateful, even as he knew once more the fear of his heart lying vulnerable outside of himself. She would continue on without him, blazing through the darkness in her way. If he could not give her back her own future, he could make a life for her that was safe, free from the retribution and strife between their families. He would end this cycle, wash the blood away. But oh, he was a coward, because he found himself seizing on that thin hope that Sophia was right, and Etta had been turned away from this task. It was harder to die than he imagined it would be, and desperately humbling. He did not want her to see him like this, no more than he wanted her in harm's way should things come to blows. He did not think he could survive a final farewell. The single power that time travel truly held over them was regret. If he could simply move back through the weeks, sift through the days, and arrive at that moment in the Belladonna's shop, of course he would have steered as far away from it as he could. But hindsight had given him something undeniably precious. Insight. Into Sophia, into himself, and into their bitter, beautiful world. All he had ever wanted to do was travel, seek out those horizons, and he had, hadn't he? He had gone farther in these weeks than the limits of his own imagination.
"If we must act quickly, and there is no time tomorrow," he told Sophia. "I would like to say that I am proud to have fought beside you. I would never again presume to tell you how you ought to live your life. I would only say, as your friend, that there's no pain more acute than words left unsaid, and business which can never be concluded."
She reached forward, pressing her hand against his mouth to silence him. Nicholas started to tug away, exasperated. But in the next moment he heard it too. Footsteps. A curt knock on the door.
"Everything okay in there, Carter?"
The Ironwood men didn't defer to him so much as guard him, watch him, judge him. He had seen the looks flying around the table after Ironwood's proclamation declaring him heir during their last, and please God, final family meeting.
"Fine," Nicholas called back. "Reciting my prayers."
"Whatever you say," the man, Owen, grumbled. "Just keep it down, will you? If you wake him up, it'll be the end of all of us."
"Too right." Nicholas waited until the footsteps receded, before turning back to Sophia. But she was already at the window, unlatching it. A slap of wind and rain struck him across the temple.
"Right. The damned tree."
"You'll break your neck,"
he said, trying to stand.
"Wait for the rain to settle. I'd rather not have to explain the presence of your broken body in the morning."
Sophia's lips curled ever so slightly upward.
"Don't be ridiculous."
She sat on the window ledge, swinging one leg over, then the next. Her gaze roved over the tree's shaking limbs, the rivers of rainwater washing the street below clean.
"She might yet return," he told her as he came to stand behind her.
Sophia turned to him one last time, the mist of the storm collecting on her face.
"No, she won't."
Our Lady of Candelaria was a stately papist, Catholic church. with all the embellishments the Baroque style of architecture had to offer. Two towers sat proudly on either side of an unfinished dome, dark granite accents contrasting neatly with its whitewashed walls. Inside, however, the design was neoclassical, its pillars and statues of angels, saints, and the Virgin Mother, carefully carved with an eye for the size and beauty of the place of worship. It was blessedly far, at least, from the all-too-prosperous slave market on Valongo Street, the fattening houses where weak and thin merchandise were cajoled into gaining weight to increase their value. And the dock itself, which had no doubt been built by the hands of slaves to welcome each subsequent shipment of innocence. Of course, that had not stopped Ironwood from walking their party of an even dozen men right through it, with all the care and sensitivity of a monster.
"What's the matter with you?"
the old man asked. Wonders abounded. The man had finally broken away from the narrow lane of focus that was the astrolabe. The last 5 days had proven that when the old man was not speaking of it, he was thinking of it. And when he was not thinking of it, it was only because he was asleep and dreaming of it. It was the first word out of his mouth in the morning, and the last one he spoke in place of his evening prayers. Conversation with Ironwood was already forced, but it had become so rote and tiresome, Nicholas actually found himself missing the man's vile threats and bitter oaths. Nicholas shifted his eyes away from the church.
"Nothing. Am I not allowed to admire beauty when I see it?"
Ironwood snorted at that.
"A terrible liar, now and forever. It's how I know I can trust you. How's the arm? Back in fighting form, I see. Good, good."
Rather than risk being left behind as a liability, someone who wouldn't be able to protect the old man from any enemies who might appear, Nicholas had removed his sling and tucked his useless hand into his coat pocket.
"It is. Wonderful, yes,"
Ironwood said, in a voice that practically sang with glee. Nicholas was instantly repulsed by the heavy hand that landed on his shoulder. The added weight of it might as well have been a mountain for how quickly his knees threatened to buckle. Owen, the short, stocky guard, emerged from the church, signaling it was clear to enter and take the passage to Japan.
"One more step,"
the man said, as he urged the two of them forward.
"One more night. Imagine her face. The future you wish to create is within your reach."
Owen held the door open for them, allowing Nicholas to duck inside without moving his paralyzed arm. And, whether he wished it or not, he did see Etta there. He saw her in the flickering of the candles. He saw her in the smooth, pale lines of the arches. He saw her in the singular way the light struck the stained glass behind the altar and colored the world. A hymn to her, a requiem to a future that was no longer his to claim.
"Yes," he said finally. "The end is in sight."
Mount Karama, 1891. 28. The centuries and continents moved around her in dark waves, and the passage's usual bellow was more of a long, continuous whistle. The difference, while pleasant to Etta's ears, was rather disconcerting. But before she had much time to consider this, her feet struck the ground, and the full weight of the gold she carried in her leather backpack brought her down to her knees. Julian tumbled out behind her, rocketing into her and sending them both down in a heap of limbs and bags. The gold plates and chalices dug into her spine.
"Ow!" she said.
"Ouch!" came the weak response. "Not one of our better landings."
"Better than the last six," Etta said, rolling out from under him. Julian lurched up to his feet, struggling to stay vertical under the weight of his pack.
"Time?"
Etta squinted at the wind-up watch they'd found tossed in with Ironwood's other treasures, still breathing hard from the run.
"10:30.
Julian punched the air in triumph.
"Told you we'd make it in time, didn't I?"
While there had been enough gold and precious stones left in the cave, Julian had previously mislabeled one of the entries in his journal, which had subsequently sent them on a hair-raising journey through Jerusalem during the First Crusade, with 20th-century clothing and more gold than anyone had any right to. The passage's whistling receded, but the drumming continued to pulse through the darkness. The vigor of the drums and chiming cymbals was breathtaking, as Etta stood, stumbling to maintain her balance on the soft incline. She was surprised to find the ancient music wasn't the heartbeat of the mountain itself. The passage had deposited them behind a line of flames that snaked up the mountain's cleared path. Etta crawled through the damp, cool mud for a closer look.
Sire! Sire!
That same phrase was being shouted over and over, for all the wild, dark world to hear. She turned to Julian for a translation.
I think... good festival. Something like that.
Julian scratched at his mussed hair. The smell of pine and smoke bled through the line of trees, carrying with it the voices of young and old alike. Stripped to their loincloths, men carried torches over their shoulders. Small ones, yes, carried by boys, really, who looked exceedingly proud to have the task. But as the torches increased in size, so did the men who carried them, until a few bore the staggering weight of torches the size of motorcycles, and likely as heavy. The men staggered beneath their weight as they wound through the one-street village below, ascending up the dirt path. Cheers of encouragement followed from the villagers walking in their footsteps, their faces lit, glowing warmly in the face of an encroaching midnight. Etta's brow furrowed. What is this? Why would this Belladonna person pick a place where we'd be more likely to bump into the people of this time?
To your first question, a festival of some sort, clearly, Julian said, turning to the task of trying to pick the dirt out from under his nails. In deference to whatever spirit or god is enshrined at the temple. To answer your second, it's best not to dwell on the dark, spider-infested maze of the Belladonna's mind. But I assume the festival will be ending soon.
She blinked. That was... surprisingly useful.
As I like to say, I always aim to disappoint in life, Julian said. That way you'll never fail to be a delightful surprise when you don't.
Etta snorted. All right, let's go. They began their climb through the trees, up and over the rocks, until at last they saw that more villagers were flowing down the mountain than up it. Soon that number sputtered to a few, and finally none. They moved on to the cleared trail without a word between them, shuffling through the black ash left behind by the fires. Etta caught a glimpse of Julian in a narrow pocket of moonlight. The smear of dirt across his cheek, the stains on his hands and knees, the way the waves of his hair seemed to stand on end. She already knew she looked like she'd been nearly trampled by horses in a street of melted manure and mud. Because she had been. I'm worried you're not going to be enough of a distraction, Etta said quietly. For me to get behind this Belladonna woman and grab the astrolabe. I might get out, but you won't.
I am a very fast runner, he told her. When sufficiently motivated.
I was thinking, maybe I should just make a bid. Win it legitimately. She glanced over at him in the darkness.
She only takes favors and secrets, Julian said, stopping to adjust the weight of his backpack. Do you think you have something Grandfather doesn't?
Etta had one thing none of the others did. She had grown up in a distant future, whereas no other traveler still alive had been born after 1945. But that future was gone, and any information from her future was worthless now. Which left one secret. One she wasn't sure the woman didn't already know. We know the real reason why Ironwood wants the astrolabe. If the woman knows that, then she can use it against him. I think it's valuable, but it still doesn't feel like a concrete plan.
I told you, he said. You're not supposed to be able to plan anything at these things. No thefts, no murders, no business deals beyond purchasing the witch's wares. You'll be as much in the dark as Grandfather, if that's any reassurance.
beyond the good work of irritating Cyrus Ironwood by forcing him to travel. The Belladonna was smart to pick a time and location where there might be witnesses, as a deterrent against bad or outlandish behavior from the travelers. As they continued up the path, Etta began to take account of the stone markers, the lanterns, the small, open, shrine-like structures with their slanting roofs and rich crimson paint. Their journey spent more and more minutes, their most precious currency. But it was a relief to see the lights were fading in the village below, like a hearth reduced to silent coals after burning through the last of its wood. In time, the only sound she could detect was the rustling of the forest's night-dwelling creatures. She breathed in the smell of the damp greens around her, comforted by the familiarity of the traces of wood smoke. Her body ached, but it was a good hurt, an earned one. Etta had fought through these last weeks, and felt no small amount of pride for surviving. "We're going to do the right thing, aren't we?" Etta whispered. "I've wanted it gone for so long that the thought of keeping the astrolabe intact feels unnatural. Maybe it's cursed. It infects the lives of everyone who comes in contact with that same darkness." Julian sighed.
"I don't know. You're the moral compass. You're supposed to tell me that."
She elbowed him lightly. Inside her pack, the gold coin sounded like heavy rain as they rubbed against each other.
"I guess in my mind it's like this, Lyndon Hemlock Spencer. The astrolabe itself has never been evil. For better or worse, it only answers to the heart of the person using it. But there isn't a person alive unselfish enough not to take advantage of it in some way. If destroying it destroys us, then we have to... I don't know. We have to hide it again once we straighten the timeline out. What Mom did years ago." Etta had been so quick to blame this journey on Rose's madness, her trauma, that she felt heartsick now just considering this. Rose might have known all along that destroying it would destroy the traveler's way of life, and that was initially why she had only hidden it. But it didn't excuse her for keeping the truth from her daughter. It didn't forgive what she had done to Alice, and it didn't explain why she had become so bent on Etta destroying it. Halfway up the mountain, her legs burning and her back aching from the weight of her pack, Etta saw a glimmer of light. The ring of it grew until she could make out the distinct shapes of lanterns twinkling in the trees above the path, and a young boy with golden hair sitting on a stool beside a large brass scale and several baskets. Behind him, a large white curtain had been hung to cover whatever lay beyond. Julian slowed beside her. The boy wore an oversized white robe, but had tugged it up when he'd crossed his legs, and she could see the fine stockings and velvet breeches underneath. At their approach, he merely flipped to the next page of the book in his lap. Julian cleared his throat, but the boy held up a finger, still eyeing the book. "Hello," Etta tried. Finally, the golden child lifted his gaze, and she almost laughed at the annoyance on his face. She knew what it was like to be interrupted in the middle of a particularly good page. "It's just the two of us in the bidding party," Julian told him, finally sliding his backpack off his shoulders with a relieved sigh.
This only served to further irritate the boy, who slid from his stool and motioned to the scale. He stepped onto one side, leaving the other for them to pile their sacks on top of, and they began their prayers that they had not misjudged the weight. "How do we know you weigh 100 pounds? Etta asked. The boy glowered back, bobbing like a ship on a wave as the scale balanced. Etta caught herself holding her breath as their side dipped lower than the boy's, only to straighten in triumph. They'd brought more than enough.
"Oh, thank goodness!" Julian rushed forward to remove some of the gold. "Would have been a shame to let all of us..." "Welcome! Welcome, my young beasties."
A woman pushed through the pale curtain, careful to close it again behind her before Etta could see what was there. Her long legs devoured the distance between them in two quick gulps, stopping uncomfortably close to Etta. She fought every natural instinct to take a step back and reclaim some semblance of comfort. Instead, Etta looked up and met the woman's dark gaze over the silver veil that covered the lower half of her face. Her full-figured body was dripping with black lace that looked as if its ornate floral patterns had been cut out from the shadows themselves. And as if she thought the occasion might call for it, she had added a silver and diamond diadem that sat on her head like a row of wolf's teeth. She exchanged a look with the golden-haired boy, who nodded some sort of confirmation. Julian wobbled a bit on his feet with what Etta believed might have been a bow that he thought better of halfway through.
"Good evening, madam. We've brought the requested entry fee." "And not much else," she said,
her cat-like eyes flitting from his face to Etta's. "It doesn't matter," Etta said, with what she dearly hoped was something resembling confidence. "When we have the secret, we do."
"Indeed."
The veil fluttered, as if she'd given a silent laugh.
"Only two of you, when others have tried to bring in nearly a dozen." "I know your rules," Julian said. "Only 8 per party."
She ignored him, her gaze still fixed on Etta.
"How curious, beastie. Yours is a face I have seen before."
She waved the other woman off. "Yeah, been getting that a lot recently."
"And such a pleasant temperament to match. Now, if you'll each please take a robe and a mask from the basket and don them. Yes, you'll need to put the hood up as well. Safety in anonymity, as I always say." "A jolly good policy, if I've ever heard of one," Julian said,
placing the mask on his face and quickly knotting it behind his head. It covered the whole of his face, save for his eyes. The woman cocked her head to the side.
"Aren't you the previously believed to be dead Julian Ironwood?" he said,
with the eagerness of someone who'd been longing to be recognized.
"Going to close your robe," the Belladonna finished,
and without any sort of preamble, took up the task of knotting the series of ties that ran down its side. Etta quickly laced her own, and tried not to laugh when the woman ran her spindly fingers down Julian's front.
"I believe you are our last bidding party. If you would follow me, you have set us back several precious moments. I cannot delay the start of the auction any further."
The woman cut in front of Etta and pulled the curtain aside. If Etta had been asked to guess what was behind it, she would not have gone with 2 dozen other white-robed, golden-masked travelers and guardians, all of whom remained facing forward, packed together like cattle in a stall. The Belladonna reached up for one of the silver lanterns hanging in the trees and held it in front of her as she pushed her way up through the ranks. Julian started to follow her, but Etta held out an arm, shaking her head. It was better if no one took particular notice of them, and moving to the front would give everyone ample time to guess who might be under the robe. As it was, no one dared to utter a single word as the pack began to follow the Belladonna and her lantern up the rest of the path, toward the temple several 100 yards away. Only one figure, bringing up the rear of the first group, risked a look back at them. He or she was the only one who allowed themselves to break from the quick march of the others, moving slowly, with an almost labored gait. Hurt, or old, maybe. Etta narrowed her eyes, wishing it wasn't so dark. Because it looked like, it seemed like, that person is slowing down, drifting back intentionally. Etta felt for the small dagger she'd plucked off a knight in Jerusalem, dread combing its cold, clammy hands through her hair, down her neck. She was so wholly focused on the figure that she did not see the movement in the forest just to the left of Julian, until something lashed out, hooking a black-cloaked arm around his neck. His shout of alarm was smothered by the gloved hand smashing against his face. Etta dove into the forest after them, the dagger in her hand. It was just like the attack in Russia. The attacker was shrouded in black, and the blade was pressed against Julian's throat, even as he struggled to disentangle himself from the powerful grip. She was a step behind the attacker, and drew her blade back to stab, The weight hit at his back and brought her down before she could catch Julian's attacker. But it was the mountain itself, its sharp decline, that sent her rolling, spinning over the soft earth and ferns, until finally her back collided with a tree big enough to catch her weight. The blow knocked the dizziness from her mind, enough that she ignored the bruising she'd taken and climbed back onto her knees, searching for Julian in the darkness above her. A short distance away, tangled in the ferns and obscured by the small stone marker, were the twisted, white-robed legs of her own attacker. Etta scrambled up the hill on hands and feet, the blade of her dagger clenched between her teeth, until the ground flattened out enough for her to stand. She swung around the edge of the stone marker, her gasping breath steaming the inside of her mask. At the very last second, rather than stab with her right hand, she threw her left fist forward, smashing into the attacker's mask and knocking them flat on their back, just as they made to rise. She dropped to her knees on their chest, ripping their mask off and bringing the blade up to their jugular. She knew this face. She loved this face. "Oh, my God!" Etta gasped, flying back, pulling her own mask up. "Oh, my God!" His eyes widened, equally stunned by the sight of her. Her hands sank into the dirt, shaking. She pulled up leaves and roots, trying to ground herself in that moment, to make it feel real to her. That valley between them that had devastated her with his absence, the one she hadn't let herself fall into, opened up again. One single soft word reached her. "Hi." Etta's heart broke open, and the relief was as painful as it was necessary. The way he looked at her now, like she was a pearl in the darkness. The way his hand reached for her, waiting for her hand, its twin. She crashed into him just as he sat up, her lips on his, stealing his breath, his surprised laughter, stealing him back into herself. "Hi," she managed, her hands cupping his face, kissing him, kissing him.
"Where have you been?"
he asked when he could.
"Where have you been?"
she demanded back, feeling his hands sink into her braid, weaving sweetness into it.
"I've been quite occupied. Was looking for you," he said. "Had a damn time of it. I might have known you'd find me first."
"Saw you. The beach."
She tasted blood from his split lip, but she didn't care. She didn't care.
"I know. I know. Thought you were..."
"I know. I'm sorry. Why did you chase me now? Why are you here?"
Etta forced herself to stop, to pull back and wrap her arms around him so he'd have the opportunity to answer. His arm came up to lock around her waist, and his forehead rested against her shoulder. He was breathing hard.
"Are we incapable of meeting under remotely typical circumstances?" Etta heard him wonder.
The damp ground was soaking through her robe, straight to her skin, but she hardly felt it. Nicholas's pulse was fluttering against her neck, nothing at all like the steady, driving beat she remembered from even their most desperate moments. It was the darkness, she was sure of it. It was only the hunger, the exhaustion, and the shadows that made him look so frail. But when her hands skimmed over his back, she felt each knob of his spine, the ridges of his ribs. Etta leaned back so she could brush a half-open kiss against his lips, his labored breathing mingling with hers.
"I can't even hold you," he whispered. "It's too much. It's all too fast. I wasn't afraid before, but I find myself just that slightest bit afraid now."
"What are you talking about?" she asked, trying to shift so she could study him, see his face. He only held her tighter, his arms shaking with the effort. Her hands came up to slide through his tufts of hair, and his scalp was warm against her palms. Nicholas strained to kiss her again, his mouth grazing the soft corner of her lips.
"I was just going for whoever looked to be about my..." Sophia's voice said behind them.
"I am not your size."
That was Julian.
"Well, would you prefer I said I went for whoever looked easiest to take down?"
She heard Sophia and Julian approach, felt the moment they were seen. The silence that followed was its own century.
What are you still doing here?
Sophia aimed the words at Nicholas, coating them with anger.
He's going to notice you're gone if you don't hurry back.
Thought she that Etta was someone who could hurt you.
It was difficult to piece together the soft fragments of his words. Her mind did the best it could. Sophia had unwittingly snared Julian to steal his robes for the auction, and seeing a disguised Etta pursue them, Nicholas had panicked, worrying that Sophia wouldn't be able to fight two people at once.
"Why are you?" Etta asked. "Tell me what's happening. Nicholas!"
The cold wash of fear as he sagged against her was nothing compared to the hurricane that came with Sophia's sharp oath. She leaped over the fallen tree that stood between them and seized Nicholas's shoulders, giving him a hard, jaw-snapping shake.
"Damn you, Carter," she said. "Not now, damn you!"
"Nicholas?" Etta couldn't stop saying his name, as if that would be enough to pull him back to consciousness.
"Tell me what's happening." "We're running out of time. That's what's bloody happening," Sophia said.
And with no other warning, slapped him across the face. 29. Even as he came to again, the darkness in his vision remained like a halo around her face, as if to dash away the dream of her. But she was still there. Etta was still there. She knelt in front of him, smelling of fire smoke, warm, sweet bread. A home. The mud that was smeared across her face had caught a single strand of her hair, sticking it to her cheek. For the life of him, he could not say why he found this unbearably endearing.
"You're not okay, are you?" she whispered.
He knew it was Sophia behind him, propping him up so he could face them. Them. Because Julian was hovering a few short feet away, looking so uncertain he was nearly unrecognizable to Nicholas.
"Julian,"
he said, letting his relief bleed into the words. He hadn't realized it until now, how grateful he was that these two had found one another. Etta would protect Julian, and Julian would ensure Etta didn't have to be alone. Hearing his name now, his half-brother drew closer to their small circle.
"This is the part where I tell you I'm a fool and an ingrate, and you punch me."
Meeting his gaze, seeing Julian's face, Nicholas thought of the rage that he'd always imagined would pour through him, boiling with years' worth of resentment and ill-humored thoughts and words. But what he felt now was simply peace. That small part of him was resolved, and thankful, and above all, glad. This was his brother, and not even death had changed his love for him.
"Perhaps another time."
He gave Sophia a meaningful look, then glanced at Etta.
"Fine,"
Sophia said, and then to Etta.
"I'm sorry about the way I treated you. I'm also sorry your mother is a demon from hell."
"I'm sorry about what happened to you, and the things I said, except for when you deserved them,"
Etta said, her words wavering, even as she tried to steady them.
"But why won't anyone answer my question? What's happening?"
His abominable pride did not let him ask for help to stand, but the others offered it regardless. Etta held both his forearms, keeping his balance for him. The fear on her face tore at him. Nicholas turned to look at Sophia and Julian.
"I need a moment."
"We don't have long," Sophia said. "I can explain it to them. Just go."
He shook his head. "God grant me time enough for this."
"It'll only be a moment. Please."
He was sure she would fight him until the breath left both of their bodies. But instead, Sophia let out a small huff and nodded. She drew Julian away, back up toward the edge of the trail. Etta turned his face back toward her own.
"Tell me," she said. "Please just tell me what's going on. Why were you with Ironwood? Are you all right? What happened to your arm?"
Of course she had noticed. "I am not completely myself at the moment,"
Nicholas admitted. There isn't time for it all. Only what is necessary. If I could pluck this moment out of time and keep us here forever, I would. But we cannot stop time. We can only write it again.
That's what I'm trying to do, Etta said. Her heart shone in her face, lit softly like a candle, as she brought it close to his, as if trying to give him her light.
He burned with the regret of it, not trusting his body to hold her the way he wanted to, without collapsing again.
But our plan, she continued, her lips close to his ear. It has to change. We can't destroy it.
And he knew devastation. Pure, unadulterated pain. Etta saw it flash in his face, and knew from the way denial pooled in her eyes. On this, they could not be reconciled. He captured her mouth again, trying to soften the blow, to find the words he needed. The cool night bit at his skin, but her lips were hot, insistent, moving over his as if to launch her own argument. Nicholas tore himself away, trying to still her long enough to reintroduce her to reason.
"It has to be destroyed. You said as much yourself," he said. "I know the consequences. I know what might come of it, but Etta, do you see? Do you feel how much of this is outside our hands? If this is ever going to end, let it be now. Your mother, she came to me in the desert, just after you were orphaned. She spoke of a war to come."
"I know all about this," Etta interrupted.
"She wasn't wrong. This is the war which never ends, the one that exists between the families," he said. "There's a shape to this, a pattern."
Etta flinched at that word, already shaking her head, trying to capture his lips again, keep him from finishing.
"No, no, no, don't say that. Don't use that word."
He deserved a bloody medal for having the will to stop her from kissing him.
"I cannot help but think there is no lasting peace between the families because there is something deeply unnatural about us. What we can do," he continued. "It must be time's revenge that we inherently repel one another. It feels to me as if these conflicts are trying to force us back to our natural times, where we're meant to be."
She lifted her pale eyes, hardened now like chips of ice.
"There is nothing more natural than families. You haven't seen what I have. There are people who love and need one another. We can still fix the timeline. It'll take longer, yes. But it's possible to do it one piece at a time."
"And then what?" he prompted. "The astrolabe is hidden again. We risk someone else resuming the search, finding it, unraveling everything we've done. This is the only way to hold Ironwood accountable, to make him answer for what he's done to us all. If not for that reason, then think of the millions upon millions of lives he's toyed with, the disregard and apathy he's shown them. He is not the exception, Etta. He is the rule. There is too much power in what we can do."
Nicholas knew it was unfair of him that he could make this decision with the callousness it required, knowing it would be one of his last. But only days before, he'd been running toward vengeance like a man on fire, burning up the last parts of his soul. Some part of her, at least, seemed to see the truth in this last argument. Her whole body tensed in frustration. He was staring down another loss, and though he had been so logical, though he knew her to be logical, he saw the stricken look of betrayal on her face, and all those arguments threatened to fly away from him. What was history anyway but the lies of the winning few? Why was it worth protecting when it forgot the starving child under siege, the slave woman on her deathbed, the man lost at sea? It was an imperfect record written by a biased hand, diluted to garner the most agreement from competing parties. He was tempted to see her point, to imagine that she could realign the past and present and future into something beautiful. God, if anyone was capable of it, it would be her. But their history, the one forged by travelers, was one of violence, war, and revenge. They had not simply made it. They were made by it.
"And what about us?" she asked.
running her small, lovely hands up to his shoulders, his neck, his face. Nicholas leaned into the calloused tips of her fingers. What if I love you, and I need you? What was the point of this? Why did we fight so hard if you were only going to give up?
Carter!
The man's voice echoed down to them, still a distance away. Owen. Atta made as if to draw him behind her, and he wanted to kiss her then more than he wanted his next breath. The seconds unraveled around him, blistered his raw heart. Stay with me, she begged. Stay with me. This isn't over yet.
This is freedom. This, the freedom from fear. This is what it means to rewrite the rules, he said. A world in which the astrolabe exists is a world in which either of us could be taken at a moment's notice. If nothing else, I'll know you'll be safe.
Alone, she corrected sharply.
Never alone, he promised. Did you not feel me with you in all of our days apart? Can you not feel my heart beating for you?
It's not the same, she said, her eyes flashing again. And you know it.
I only know this. Our paths were separated by centuries, but we converged. No matter the outcome, my destiny has always been joined to yours. Carter! Where the hell are you?
Atta leaned forward into him, her face against the curve of his neck. Don't do this. Please don't do this.
Do you believe in that world you spoke of? The one made for us?
She swallowed, nodding. Her soft lips were against his bare skin, and he was a man, damn it all, and he was burning for her. The words that escaped him were choked with emotion.
If we aren't to have it in this life, then in the next. If not now, then we'll have it forever.
She pulled back, only to surge up onto her toes and grip him fiercely by his robe. The kiss shot down his spine like lightning striking a mast, blowing him apart. It wasn't a retreat, and it was far from a surrender. She invaded his every sense at once, the way the sun first breaks in the morning and illuminates the horizon. The taste of her, the smell of her, those small sounds she made in her throat, all of these things were secrets entrusted to him, prizes he had fought so desperately to retake. Atta seized every part of him at once, and he pushed the deadening dread away, let the frantic joy of her rush through him, flooding the empty places, turning him inside out. His skin felt drummed tight wherever her lips touched, and Nicholas wondered, in those spaces between the battering of his heart, how it was possible that she was so soft when all of the days that had led them here had been so very hard. She did not cry, his brave girl, but he felt the rage beneath her skin, moving her to fit against his body, to disappear into him.
Nicholas! Sophia called softly. He's coming!
The blade hanging over them fell at last. Nicholas eased back from her, wondering if this was what death would feel like, the painful release. He had envisioned it so many times as wading out into dark, cool water, letting it rise past his hips, his shoulders, his head. This was a breaking, a thunderclap of agony. How short a person's life was, but how many times they were asked to die inside.
I love you, he told her softly. Time can never steal that.
And somehow, before she spoke, Nicholas knew what she was about to say. Her face was steeled, defiant. I'm not giving up, Atta said, the loose strands of her hair flying about her face, a shining storm of a girl.
I won't destroy it. This isn't the end.
Nicholas turned her hand over, pressing one last burning kiss into her palm.
Then may the best pirate win. Hurry it up, will you?
Owen wasn't a large man by any means, but his voice could absolutely thunder when the situation called for it. He had lifted his mask and was scanning the dark line of the forest for Nicholas. Sophia was right then. The old man had noticed he was gone, and more quickly than he would have expected.
"I managed to get turned around," Nicholas said, limping up to him.
The other man took in the sorry state of his stained robes.
"What kind of fool falls while taking a piss?"
"You do."
Sophia had moved so quickly, looping in a large circle back up to the trail behind Owen, that neither man noticed her until she brought the rock crashing down on his head. The whites of his eyes flashed as he crumpled. Nicholas watched in appreciation as Sophia stripped the robe and mask off him, and set about rolling Owen off the trail, into the forest, where the mountain did the rest of the work in carrying him away.
"Did you finish your business?" she asked innocently.
"Did you?"
He pushed back. Julian had gone ahead with Etta, and while there was much she wished he could have said to his half-brother, there was likely quite a bit more that needed to be spoken between the formerly betrothed pair. A gong sounded from above, where the graceful temple sat at the top of the trail. Nicholas straightened his mask and accepted Sophia's offered shoulder as support for the last few yards of their climb. They passed through the structure with its airy, open foundations, the upward slant of its roof, to find an enormous white tent pitched in the center of its stone courtyard. So then, they would not be trampling over a sacred place. Good. Perhaps the Belladonna still had some scraps of decency clinging to her tattered soul. The scent of wine and spirits floated to him on the next autumn breeze, followed by the sweet notes of fruit. A short distance from the tent, a table was elegantly piled with food, though it had clearly already been ravaged by the others. The Belladonna stood beside it, waiting for them.
"Help yourselves, of course," the Belladonna said, turning to greet a man who Nicholas thought must have been a priest or a monk, based on his ceremonial robes, different from the ones the travelers donned.
He seemed harried, hovering near the tent but not daring to enter. The woman shooed him away by blowing a kiss.
"Is he a guardian?" Nicholas asked. "No. Return a few legendary national treasures, and you'll be surprised by the favors people will do for you," the Belladonna said. "And the things they're willing to forget."
Sophia snorted, drawing the woman's eyes over to her. The Belladonna hummed thoughtfully but said nothing.
"If you are ready, follow me. The rest of your party is already situated."
The tent was far larger than it had appeared on the outside, so much so that he wondered if it might be one of the Belladonna's illusions. The central aisle led up to a raised and gilded table, on which a dark wooden box had been placed. Two masked men stood on either side of it, swords in hand, as if prepared to slice any who dared to reach for it. If he hadn't felt it just then, that chill creeping over his skin, the tremor in the air, Nicholas might not have believed the astrolabe to be inside.
"Do you,"
Sophia whispered, almost sounding faint, "feel that?" The Belladonna jerked her head around.
"Silence. Here. Here is your place."
Lining the long aisles were stalls, divided by heavy white fabric that looked, to Nicholas's biased eye, like sailcloth. At least one dark shape of a man or woman appeared to be sitting in each, backlit by a lantern or an arrangement of candles. So that was it, then. How she managed to further the anonymity of the bidders, and likely the winner who would be taking any of her auctioned goods home. "Where is Etta?"
"You,"
she said, brushing his shoulder with her long, curling nails,
"are designated as a bidder. Present your offer when I call for the fourth bidder, should you survive that long."
As she leaned in closer, he breathed in that same earthy scent, as if she were a dark forest wearing a woman's skin.
"There's still time, of course."
Nicholas ignored the tremor in his heart as he said softly,
"Good evening to you, ma'am."
The Belladonna stood to the side, lifting the entrance to their stall. Inside, the Ironwoods were lifting their masks to taste the proffered food and wine. but they instantly slid them back into place. Sophia stepped in beside him, edging around the room to avoid too much notice that she was not, in fact, Owen.
"There he is,"
Ironwood said as the curtains shut behind them, still mercifully in possession of his good mood.
"Now it begins."
His footsteps were soft against the rugs and pillows provided. There was little else, beyond a few candles and a small wooden table. Nicholas surrendered himself heavily to the floor. The bruises and cuts he'd acquired were a low throb of pain, but they were nothing compared to the fire searing his veins. Instead of letting himself notice the twitching of his left hand, he focused on the foul smell of the pipe someone was smoking in the stall beside theirs. The Belladonna had placed them directly in the middle of the stalls, but save for that whiff of bad air and the murmur of the ironwood men around him, he could not hear or see evidence of any of the other bidders. He could not even hear the wind outside. The gong sounded again. With a kick of his heart, Nicholas turned back toward the curtain draped over their stall's entrance, and beyond that, the muted shapes of the Belladonna and her guards.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you to tonight's auction. As always, your silence is mandatory. I have taken a liberty, shall we say, to ensure this. I will be able to hear you, but to protect the privacy of the winner, you will not be able to hear one another."
Ironwood drummed his fingers against his knees, nodding repeatedly in an eager, childlike manner. The man's entire world was winnowed down to this moment, as he stood on the edge of grasping the only thing that had ever been truly denied him.
"The winner of this item will be liable for its transportation and protection outside the barriers of this site. All sales, regardless of satisfaction, are final and binding. Upon the conclusion of the auction, the winner will be allowed to leave first, followed by the rest of you in the order of my choosing. Rather than conduct multiple rounds of bids, please submit your best offer as it stands. I will call each designated bidder forward to hand it to me."
Nicholas's fingers dug into the muscles of his thighs. He dropped his eyes to the floor. Please God, keep her safe. Let this end.
"I thank the consigners who entrusted me with this sale. Without further ado, I present lot 427, a purported astrolabe."
Purported? Nicholas actually laughed.
"Of unknown, ancient origins. A first bidder, please."
Nicholas leaned forward, trying to peer through the smallest of gaps where the side of the stall met the curtain. His breathing had taken on an uneven quality that made darkness dance in his vision. Essa. Where was Essa?
"The second bidder, please."
Hell and damnation, he thought, wiping the sweat from his forehead, his eyes. He tasted rust in his mouth. Not yet. Not yet, damn you. A dark splatter, dark enough to show through the thick fabric, whipped against the curtain directly across from theirs. Nicholas and Sophia jumped to their feet, just as the bidder's lifeless body, still spilling blood, was thrown out of the stall. A darkness deeper than night, exploding after him. 30. As she made her way up to the Belladonna, Etta squared her shoulders. The scrap of paper on which she'd written her offer, a secret about Ironwood's desires, soft and damp in her hand. The candles' flames shook in their stands. The dimly flickering light outlined each of the stalls as she passed them. It was the silence that was unleashing her anger, unbraiding the knot of fury she'd wrapped around herself. Her hands clenched by her side again, as if to keep the feel of Nicholas's rough skin trapped there a moment longer. May the best pirate win. It wasn't even that they were at odds. She understood his line of reasoning, even as she wanted to strangle him for simply accepting it. It was what he had so clearly withheld, the reason why the fire had left his heart. Why, when she kissed him that last time, he had shuddered, as if on the verge of shattering. Something's wrong. Something is so